This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. Or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious. Makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Rick, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. We're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We have a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were, a country where people help each other. All right. Well, we have a really good show tonight. The first guest is going to be Jim Napolitan. He joins me in this second week of every month from the Chicago area. And he has some very interesting things to say on mostly economic topics. So I'm going to be adding him in right now. There we go. Whoops. Okay. We're calling him right now. I believe he's up in the Chicago area. Okay.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Jim. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, I really appreciate you being part of this show. And I think you had a very interesting sounding topic. So I'm going to just ask you to go right ahead.
Well, I think there's been a fascinating response to the market action today. For those who don't follow the market on a daily basis, and I can't blame you, the consumer price index figure came out today. Everybody has been looking for a rather grim figure, and it wasn't good, but it was much better than expected. And what that led to was a takeoff to the upside in the stock market, the Dow gaining over 1,100, huge update, biggest one in about 3 or 4 years. And now, the reason, the logic of this is that a lower rate of inflation will be judged by the Fed as their interest rate upticks have been working. And it's been widely expected that in the next round, we'd again have another half point to three quarters of a point, and that the end level would have the federal rate up around 5.5%. It seems clear that Powell, the head of the Fed, wants to, if anything, be overshoot. He doesn't want to allow inflation to get embedded in the economy. It is a very legitimate worry, because once inflation gets built into people's expectations, then they demand higher wages. The higher wages, of course, then tend to raise the rate of inflation as that money gets spent, and you get into a wage price spiral. And that's an unhealthy phenomenon, the cost of which breaking is very high. Paul Volcker did it 40 years ago by taking interest rates up between 15% and 20%. And that broke the back of the inflation of the 70s. The price, a very deep recession, 1980, 81, 82. Now, that's the monetary side. Part of the reason that people have been very concerned about these high interest rates is because we, on the monetary side, is because at the same time, we haven't had fiscal restraint. The government has, over the last 3 years, been spending money, borrowed money, at an incredibly high, about $5 trillion has been pumped into the economy. And that's increased the demand level dramatically. Lacking fiscal restraint, and one thing you don't hear, haven't heard for quite a while now, is any candidates to go out and talk about reducing spending. It's just not been part of our philosophy for some time now. And rather, it's more who you're going to tax and what are you going to spend money on. The perception going into this election had the market rallying was that the Republicans would likely have a large wave wave election, could be very substantial, and it would be a return of fiscal restraint. With more fiscal restraint, you need less monetary restraint to control inflation. The initial result, then, the first thing that happened election eve was, as the Democrats were doing substantially better than expected, the stock market started falling. I'm talking about overnight. Okay, the market was falling, and it was looking weak coming into today, and then the consumer price index figure came out at 8:30 Eastern, and the market just took off to the top side. All of a sudden, philosophy, the thinking was completely changed. Those people who were short and sold stock funds that were overly cautious now were all jumping back in. And we ended up with an incredibly strong up day. Where it goes from here, don't know, but the perception of the market is right now, I think the general perception is that we are going to end up with divided government. That is, it looks pretty likely that the Republicans will control the House, and and the Senate is going to be a toss-up, likely coming down to a runoff in Georgia, where who haven't paid attention to it, if neither candidate gets 50%, they run off the top two candidates. Well, you had a Libertarian running in Georgia who got about 2% of the vote, and consequently neither Walker nor Warnock got the necessary 50%. there'll be a runoff. Should be a very interesting one. You may remember that Warnock won his seat position in a runoff 2 years ago. And but that was a different circumstance. And this is what's interesting here, is in that case, Trump was mad about his loss and told people not to vote. And sure enough, in North Georgia, where an awful lot of conservative voters are, was light on the turnout. And Warnock, who is heavily favored in Democratic strongholds like Atlanta, managed to win. Plus, Warnock was a black man. And so people were voting in part on wanting to have this very well-spoken black man. He was a minister at Martin Luther King's church. So this time around, though, we'll have two black men running against each other. So race won't be the consideration. I would just point those out as part of the discussion you're going to be hearing at length and maybe ad nauseum over the next month, because an election looks like it's going to be pivotal. In all likelihood, Kelly will win in Arizona, and likely Laxalt for the Republicans in Nevada. So that's the political scenario for right now. The history is that when you have divided government, okay, that is not the White House, Congress, and Senate are not all in one hand. The stock market performs relatively well. In part, less gets done. And now here's an interesting datum for you. If you take all of the days of the stock market, okay, over the last 100+ years, the market goes up more on days when Congress is not in session.
Okay.
The good folks are a little afraid that you've got to protect your money when Congress is in session. Go to the sidelines. So given that, now it's going to be a very thin margin for the Republicans, but in all likelihood suggests that the likely view is new large spending programs by Biden are likely dead. Quite possibly loan forgiveness is going to go by the by. Other very expensive programs. Loan forgiveness alone was probably going to cost $1 trillion over the next decade. And there's going to be some relief on the expenditure side of the budget. All of that said, with less pressure on the monetary side, we may at least not have a deep recession, but a perhaps softer recession. And the market was acting today like, who knows, maybe we're not going to get a recession. Big change in the market today. I think I would watch closely to see if it holds on to these gains over the next few days. If so, it starts looking a good bit more positive. I can tell you here's the interesting wrinkle. 20 days ago, the stock market was exactly right here. So what we have, if it starts going down from here, it might be looking like what in the market they call a double top. That is not positive. This market is in a longer, a 6-month downtrend. This rally may be just a bear market rally, a bear trap. And so we will watch closely. I watch even in the overnight market. Okay, so the market, is trading right now. the S&P 500, the Dow, and the NASDAQ all trade 24 hours a day. The only time they're stopped.
Really?
Is, yes. Okay. The few, they're, so you can buy a fund, the QQQs for the NASDAQ, the SPYs, the Spiders for the S&P 500, okay, and the Dow. So you can do any one of them. Right now, in the aftermarket, they're all up a little bit more. So it closed strong, and they're up a little. That doesn't say anything more than what people are expecting is right now you have two major areas of markets that are open, and that's Asia and China. Okay, those markets are looking at what happened today, and people over there are likely buying the market. We'll have to wait till, okay, let me take it a step further. At 4 o'clock in the morning, much more active trading starts in stocks, U.S. stocks that are traded in Europe. So you can see, for example, Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, how they're trading at 4 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow morning. And that will be predictive of likely where they're going to open the when the U.S. stock market opens. Let me give it for your listeners that aren't aware, there is pre-opening trading in the U.S. on those same stocks that would start at 7 o'clock in the morning. So you can buy and sell most any stock. Now, they may be rather thin in the bids and offers. They may be far apart. Not so very much with the big stocks like Amazon, but starting at 7 o'clock in the morning. And TD Ameritrade, Schwab, will let you trade those extended hours, they call it extended hours trading. And then the full market opens at 9:30. Now, I point that out. The reason I point out this is that this sort of trading, if you think about trading, is now completely an electronic phenomenon. Orders aren't manually handled in any way anymore. If they're electronically entered, electronically crossed, that is, buyers and sellers meet, then there's no particular inherent reason why any market shouldn't be open 24 hours a day. Okay. And I would predict that within the next few years, that will be the gradual trend such that our current trading day, on the East Coast, 9:30 to 4, where main trading occurs, may be less structured, more amorphous, floating well into the evening, going around the clock, so that anybody could at least put in a bid or an offer on any stock at any time. The 24-hour trading is definitely coming at us. Right now, you can already trade. Also, I point out, you can trade the currencies 24 hours a day. You can trade gold 24 hours a day. So there's a number of major trading opportunities out there, all particularly enabled by electronic trading. So anyway, that's the interesting thing with the stock market, though, is we've been in a bear market the whole year, and we're still down substantially, 15%+ on the year, and actually probably more than that, I should say. The NASDAQ is down over 20. This rally may not have legs. It would not surprise me to see this rally evaporate. So that's a market perspective. Political perspective, I'm sure you're getting other multiple reactions out there.
No doubt.
Yeah. If anything, I would say I draw two broad conclusions at this point. One, that it's fortunate the election wasn't held 6 months ago. it would have been a disaster for the Democrats. But there was a good bit of evidence. There's evidence now that the abortion decision made a difference. Probably the most important part was it energized Democrats, who were way 6 months ago, they were very low on the enthusiasm measures. It was clear that 6 months ago, Republicans were much more enthusiastic. Second is Mr. Trump's suggestions, intervention, support was largely a negative, with one or two exceptions, but it's hard to point to very many where his support helped, and in many cases was disastrous. And I would point out a third phenomenon that I've never seen before, was that the heaviest support for the most right-wing characters that Mr. Trump put forth were the most the economic support was not from Mr. Trump. Apparently, he was very stingy with his campaign funds, but rather from Democratic campaign funds. They literally successfully chose which candidate they wanted to run against in the primaries. It was cynical and, to me, gave away a lot of moral high ground. But I can tell you, for example, here in Illinois, there was a very solid black Republican mayor of Aurora that was running for governor against our current governor, who is Mr. Pritzker. And Pritzker is a billionaire, so probably about $3.5 billion inherited money. And he gave heavy money to support the most right-wing Republican candidate and ran ads and so forth. And sure enough, the black Republican centrist mayor lost in the primary, and then Pritzker easily defeated the right winger that replaced him. Cynical? Yes. Effective? Yes. Democrats gave heavy money to have Mastroianni. You can go around and take a look. There's so this is a new phenomenon. I've never seen official Democratic money going into Republican candidates' coffers to help strengthen and select the candidate. Expect we could see this again in the more of this in the future.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you think that this tactic has been used by Republicans against Democrats in the past?
No, because what you would probably do is target the most left-wing ones and assumption that they're the least electable. And but the fact is the Democratic Party has been moving to the left, and those people have quite adequate fiscal support. So there wouldn't be much, in most of the cases, I don't think there'd be much gained. The interesting phenomenon is the movement of the parties. I had the opportunity to talk with Congressman Bobby Scott. He, a black liberal Democrat, and we talked about the idea that the parties have shifted their character and quality. That is, the Democratic parties, they've been, Democrats have moved more to the left, Republicans to the right. It used to be 50 years ago, you had liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats. He said he had looked at a study that showed that if you took the Senate, there is not a single current senator who's Democrat, who is rated as more conservative than any Republican. And conversely, there is no Republican senator that's rated as more liberal than any Democratic senator. So what we have is a curious evolution. It looks to me like the parties, what we are developing, is not a two big tent parties, but rather a liberal and a conservative party, each with heavy populist wings. And it's the populist wings that have been prominent in the last couple of years. Certainly, the populist left wing moved Biden a long ways to the left, and such that a relative centrist like Manchin was vilified within his own party, and as was Sinema in Arizona when she said she didn't want corporate tax increases. Now, you and I are old enough to remember people like Scoop Jackson, Sam Nunn, who are conservative Democrats pro-military. Can't find such a person right now. We used to have someone like a Nelson Rockefeller, a liberal Republican from the Northeast. Again, hard to find them. Those folks aren't there. Second fascinating phenomenon has been that the working classes have moved significantly to the Republicans. Increasing the breakdown, if you look at all the post-vote analyses, but it was already there in 2018 and 2020, the black vote and Hispanic vote increased substantially in 2020 over 2016. Trump got more, 6 to 10% more of each. Those people, there's movement in the working class. The Republicans are increasingly the party of the working class, and the Democrats, the party of the college educated, particularly college educated women. And so we have two parties that are in some sense trading positions. The Democratic Party used to always claim to be the party of the working man. But in point of fact, the working man is the one who is leaving them, and vice versa. It used to be that the suburbs were solidly Republican. Now the suburbs, particularly women in the suburbs, college-educated women in the suburbs, going heavily Democratic. Big shift. So I think we've got a fascinating political phenomenon going on. For example, the attitude towards gays is probably somewhat more conservative among black people than it is among the general population. Similarly, that may well be true among Hispanics. Another area that fascinates me is that both parties are not really representing, there are people in both parties that aren't very well represented on the issue of abortion. 20% of Democrats are anti-abortion, and roughly 20% of Republicans are in favor of abortion. Neither have a good home in their party on that issue. It used to be you had pro-life Democrats. You know, Chuck, look around. Can you point one out right now? Not easy.
Probably not.
Does one
come
to your mind? No. And pro-choice Republicans. Is I would think. I don't see any change coming in this issue because I think there's a way to coalesce around a position that 60 to 70% of the population would probably go with something like Roe v. Wade, maybe moving the timing up to the 15-week point. And whereas you might have general popular support for that, and by the way, I would point out That was what Justice Roberts tried to persuade the court to do, and he simply couldn't get traction on it. That would be now for the life of me, I don't know why, when the Democrats controlled both houses strongly, which they have at multiple points over the last three decades, why they didn't simply enact Roe v. Wade into formal law. It's a touchy one. I think they assumed that they would never have a problem with the Supreme Court. This is in that broad category of unenumerated laws that aren't that issues that are unenumerated within the Constitution. And now, such unenumerated issues within the Constitution, if you follow the Constitution, are to be handled by the states. If there had been a federal law of Roe v. Wade, I would have no doubt it would have withstood constitutional testing. But as an unenumerated right, then it was wide open to being. And even at the time, there were people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the left who said it wasn't good. It wasn't a good action. Legally speaking, wasn't on very strong grounds. It has happened. It's happened on both sides. I would point out that's going to remain an issue. And I just don't see a resolution. Do you see anything happening there?
All I see is a lot of arguments, and a lot of people are going to be hurt by the current situation, I think. But I don't really see a resolution, good or bad. I don't see much happening.
Well, certainly at the extreme, the ultimate extreme, of course, is actual legal threat against doctors for giving, the ultimate extremes, whether you could even give out advice on this. Would we think a doctor can legally tell you how to best poison your neighbor? No.
Okay.
There are obvious things that could be illegal for doctors. Mm-hmm. Now, and I don't say that I shouldn't be too lighthearted about this. It's an incredibly serious matter. It does have to do with the issue of at what point and in what way does the general populace construe a fetus as acquiring humanity? Mm-hmm. And at what point? And that's been the core of the argument. And one of the things that the Democrats had going for them was that there was not a strong argument as to you never heard in the discussion of rights, what is the right, what rights does the fetus have? I would point out most of the population would not approve of somebody saying this baby should be aborted. It's 8 months old and I just found out it's a boy and I wanted a girl. Okay. That's not going to be acceptable to the vast majority of the population. Mm. So most of the population does not want unlimited abortion.
Right.
I've always wondered, what is the legal status? If I shoot a pregnant woman and kill the baby and she's due to go into the hospital the next day to give birth, okay, am I charged with manslaughter or murder?
Yeah.
Okay. If I shoot that or arms the next day, and kill it. Mm-hmm. That's murder. Okay. Mm. I've never heard anybody give me a good legal argument as what the status of that is. So maybe on one of their talk shows, you could ask some lawyer types where that stands.
Interesting.
But my larger interest, as you can see, is both the politics and the issues and how these tie into the economics of the country. For right now, this country is still digesting a vast amount of spending. I'll just point out, in the broad sense, here's the larger question. How much should we be transferring cost to the next generation? How much should cost be transferred from the young, benefits be transferred from the young to the old? At this point, it's hard to argue that all of this debt, eventually all debt has to be paid, and it's going to be paid by the young people in one form or another. What are we to do about Social Security? Social Security is about 8 years from being bankrupt, no longer being able to fully fund the system. Okay. Underwater. What are we to do about that? The politicians who raise it are immediately there's people mostly on the left who vilify any attempt to look at bringing under cost any sort of cost and benefit control. Is Social Security to remain an insurance system, or is it to become a welfare system? Historically, it's been an insurance system. You earned your benefits because you put your money into it.
Exactly.
Okay. But if we start dictating that the federal government will now take on the burden of enlarging Social Security, if you want to extend it, for example, down to 50, as been proposed, then you're really making it a welfare system, which benefits older people at the expense of younger. This discussion isn't occurring. By the way, it is very different in many of the European countries. They tend to put in much more beneficial things, admissions, cheaper admissions, for example, for young people and students. And very few senior citizen cost exemptions and so forth. They don't have senior rates on movies, for example. I just point out we have a philosophy, but it's worked relatively well not to address Social Security. It's almost like the third rail, the tripwire. You don't want to touch it. Well, Democrats run against it. Okay, run against anybody wanting to change it, and at the same time, you've got a vehicle going downhill at an accelerating speed without brakes, and it's in trouble. Same thing is true for Medicare. Okay, where are we going to be on Medicare? I don't know, but I'm suggesting we have a problem ahead of us. Medicare is not going to be able to meet its cost. That is short of very substantial tax increases on Social Security. One way out of this, which was suggested by the Clinton people, because they could see the problem coming when all the baby boomers simultaneously retired. They knew this in the late 90s. The projections were obvious what was going to happen come around the year 2015, 2020. And one suggestion was to reduce the future demand on Social Security monies was to allow people to some degree opt out some portion of their expected return. instead of getting, well, here was like one suggestion was, instead of getting 100%, you'd get 80% of the money. And your a portion of your current contribution would, instead of going into the Social Security Trust Fund, would go into what amounted to a giant investment fund. The investment fund would be invested in, broadly speaking, in the stock market and in bonds. And here's the problem. The Social Security funds, as they exist, to the extent we have a Social Security Trust Fund, are invested in Treasury notes, Treasury short-term Treasury bills. I've mentioned this before. They're earning, well, for the last 5 years, they've been earning literally nothing. Had the money been in the stock market, it would have had a substantial return. And that is why you'll find very, very few companies and who are not giving people who are funding pensions with a defined benefit. Rather, it's a defined contribution. Your money goes into investment fund, and your eventual return is way better, much better. My mother, my dad was a Presbyterian minister. My mother at the end of her life was getting an amount from the Presbyterians almost twice as much as dad ever made. Because of the growth in the investment funds over that period of time. It makes a great deal of sense for our Social Security monies to be invested and then participating in the growth of the economy. Consider this, over the last 100 years, the stock market has returned an average of 8% plus a year. Bonds have returned 2.5%. Cash has returned 2%. Bonds have returned about 3.5%, I should say. Cash has returned about 2%. Cash is really where we're at with Treasury bills. They're a cash alternative. This is a tremendous multiplier effect over time. So it won't be discussed, but if you put, I would submit that if you put all the Congress people into a room, said you've got 24 hours to resolve this, or you're all out of your jobs. We'll elect a complete new Congress. Okay? They would have it resolved, and in all likelihood, it was more like what I'm suggesting, what the Clinton people were suggesting. By the way, the Clinton suggestion to have 20% of the a person could opt to have 20% of their Social Security tax payment go into a fund was rejected by the Republicans. Why? Because it would be a government-run investment fund. Granted, it would have been the largest investment fund going away. It was enormous. They thought it should be controlled by the individuals. In essence, a super large IRA. Never happened. But if you, for example, would simply say a person can put their money, you could put 20% of your Social Security money, you could put into your IRA. You'd have two things happen that would be rather fanatic. One, you'd have less required payout for the Social Security fund going forward for the next umpteen years. Two, an enormous amount of new capital coming into the investment arena, tremendous investment coming into the country. And that would be hugely profitable for all concerned. So anyway, I didn't mean to get off that. But it's one, it's a topic to return to. For now, tax increases are probably, assuming the Republicans take control, tax increases are likely dead, and corporate taxes are not going to go up further. There will be some movement to make at least some of the Trump tax cuts permanent. Don't know that that'll get through, and likely it might be vetoed by the president. I'd point out that the corporate tax rate cuts were enormously effective It may be as much as $1 trillion of U.S. money, profits that was parked overseas came back into the economy. And that's why you had both manufacturing and production increases at the same time, no inflation and incredibly low unemployment at the end of the Trump years. It was the one part of policy that I'd say I found most supportive. It freed up a tremendous amount of investment capital. And you had to say very substantial real growth. It's always to be looked at. Do you have real growth or do you have inflation growth? It doesn't do much good if I give you a 6% wage increases when prices are going up 8%.
Yeah.
But if I give you a 2% increase with no inflation, now you have a real 4% increase. Real gains were being made, and they were being made, interestingly, in the last 2 years of the Trump administration. And I speak this as no lover of Mr. Trump, but they were being the largest percentile gains were being made by the lowest quintile of workers. People in the low income categories were gaining the most, relatively speaking. Fascinating, huh? The lowest quintile. And that made, in fact, partly why Trump was getting increased votes in the working classes. Yeah. Even though it's hard to point to anything that Trump said that was particularly pro-black or certainly pro-Hispanic. I mean, he did not do any sort of vocal pandering to that group.
Yeah,
Kevin
right.
did, right? The opposite.
Right. But as you the phrase you used on one of our other talks was people vote with their pocketbook, and so that certainly seems to fit this situation.
That's true. Now what we're going to be looking at, and I won't take up too much more of your time, but over the next 2 or 3 months is there a recession developing? Are we getting forward-looking signs of it? And what are those signs? We can talk more about that the next time.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim. This has been a fascinating analysis, and I really appreciate your going into depth on the explanations. And kind of dumbing it down for those of us who are not financial wizards. thank you so much.
Yeah, very good. Look forward to seeing you at Thanksgiving.
I look forward to seeing you as well. All right. Very good.
All right.
Thanks
again. Later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listeners, a fascinating talk with Jim Napolitan. And I think we have just about enough time now to bring you the talk I had earlier with Frank Cordero from the Des Moines Catholic Worker. So here we are, Frank Cordero, the Des Moines Catholic Worker.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank. How are you?
Well, we're bundling up here. We're going into a deep freeze. I think it'll get like, 30s in the day and teens in the night. It's like a 40-degree difference between today and tomorrow. That's what they're saying. So that's the new normal. Things come in very hard and quick. That's in the offing. I'm just completing my day. I've been waiting for your call. I was able to give this talk, and now I got the recording back. It was in pieces. The poor guy, Eric Hayes. He's teaching at a community college. He's the grandson of Helen Oster, a blessed saint of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. You know, there are some women who have come through our community as helpers and the elder women, women who have either were married, their husbands pass on, or they come with their husbands. But just blessed, cherished elderly women. The first one was Helen Kitchy. It was in August. We were just open like the first couple weeks. And she comes through the door. Joe DeVee and I look at her, you know. And she says, "Is this the Catholic worker?" We said, "Yeah." She says, "Oh, I've been reading about the workers since the 1930s. I never thought I'd see one in Iowa." She had just retired from teaching. She was one of our best supporters. And Helen Oster is someone like that. She was the youngest of seven daughters. And she's the survivor. She was the survivor, all seven of them. Her husband loved him dearly, raised a couple kids, George, never got political, you know, never got involved in anything. When he died, she started to get involved with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And then she discovered us. And again, really, you know, retired elderly women have been the bedrock upon helping us witness for peace in Des Moines over the years, and the Catholic worker. So I say all this because he's a nice guy, and he's speaking speech, and he's got to have someone give a persuasive speech. So this is the second time. He had me do it when he was teaching at Drake. He could teach part-time job. Nice. But I got to go and give a spill, a persuasive speech. And the speech was following Jesus in a pro-rich, pro-war, pro-U.S. empire Christian nation. And I got to perform in front of about 25 community college kids, a few grown-ups, and I had a good time. And I don't get to talk enough. For me, you know, I feel like I'm living the parable of that prophet I spoke of. That when people spoke to me back in the early days, well, yeah, but what do you hope to change? You know, and I always told them, well, you know. As long as they're speaking the truth, and I talk about that prophet that kept going to Nineveh, and eventually no one listened to him, and the line he gave us to the kids who were throwing shit at him, saying, like, you are worthless, there's no reason for you to be here, no one's listening to you. And the killer line is, he says, well, I used to come in hopes to change the city. Now I come in hopes the city don't change me. I'm in that thing. Yeah. It's called the loser's excuse. For being shunned and not being paid attention. I usually give these talks to these kids, and I wow them, and I'm not bragging, they just haven't got a clue what to say about my perspective and where I'm coming from. Like, where do you go with a guy who says, Jesus really meant when he said, love your enemies. So listen to this. You can't kill them and love them at the same time. How's that for a punchline? Anybody get it? You know, and I'm just that kind of outrageous. So I'm entertaining. So at one point of the talk, you know, I'm looking for, you know, no one's got any questions. I said, well, listen, it's supposed to be a persuasive speech. Yeah, I'm not sure I hit that mark, but would you give me that? I entertain you. And they all said, yes.
All right.
I said, well, listen, I hit the mark. I hit my mark, you know, because if you have a message, it no matter how difficult, if you're entertained, you have a chance to communicate, and you're not making people move. So that's a but rare occurrences. I don't know. I also in that vein, being 72 and wanting to collect myself and leave some kind of witness and a perspective. I'm looking for someone who will help me just start editing some of this paper, written word stuff I got, so that I could put together something that might be publishable. I'm thinking that maybe some, I don't know, So I'm rumbling in my head. And, of course, everybody my age is trying to get their memoirs
right.
out. So there you have it. All that being said.
I would throw my hat in the ring there, except that I'm so overcommitted right now that I don't know when I would actually get to it. So,
I hear you. Yeah. Well, I don't want anybody to stop doing good stuff.
Well,
for sure. Yeah. So we ponder that as we think about the next step. I think about the last 2 years. The beauty of the weekly confessional here with Father Chuck Gregory and the Episcopal Confessional Box up to the mic. Speak a little louder, Father. And then I really do appreciate this discipline. It's now become one of my personal spiritual things because I don't hear from anybody. I don't believe anybody listening. The FBI guy maybe might be getting some entertainment out of this. But, I tried to hard a discussion with him or her. I don't want to be sexist, for God's sake. All that being said, God, I'm an ornery guy. The other thing, I'm just getting under and under. I'm again reminded that I'm so much more like my mom than my father. Just so kind of really traumatic for me because my dad, I held my dad in the highest ideal. However, I only knew him until I was 18. There's a lot of life out
there. Yeah, there is.
Could have a lot of questions. I had a lot of issues. I didn't get the bumps off my father. Let me tell you, I got the bumps off my mom. Boom, boom. I tell you, and then she became one of my best partners in the world.
All right, folks, that was Frank Cordero from the Des Moines Catholic Worker. Before that, we had Jim Napolitan. We've got a good show on the other side of the station break. Don't leave.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone. Thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. We are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And we closed that first section with a recorded interview from Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. We're going to kick off the second half of our show with a recorded interview from Richard Flamer at the Catholic Worker Farm in Chiapas, Mexico. Here we go, Richard Flamer.
Okay. Yeah, the I've been, it's titled, Why Are You Living in Mexico? I recently had a friend who I hadn't met in a couple of years, haven't seen in a couple of years. She wrote to me and said, and asked me that question, which is kind of interesting because she had been married to a Mexican who was later convicted of drug dealing. And she moved with her two kids back to the U.S. and became a nurse and is doing quite well these days. But she asked me, why are you living in Mexico? And what a question for me. I've been pondering my answer for the last 3 weeks, trying to make notes to understand a little more. At times I think it's for my spirit. Other times I think it was for romance. Occasionally, I think it was destiny. In my 30s, I was involved with a group of Catholic workers who met each Sunday for a mass at a homeless shelter and went to Offutt Air Force Base for a demonstration against the use of nuclear arms. As a soldier, I served in Vietnam, seeing firsthand the futility of war. I joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War on my return, but soon grew tired of the rhetoric without any action. the Catholic workers were different. As I became more religious, I continued pursuing my life as a rare book dealer and general contractor. The books in the winter and construction in the spring and summer. I drank too much. I was too involved with the life of a rich, slowly drawn to the life of serving others simultaneously. Reading a liberation theology, I decided to go on a vacation to Nicaragua to see what the priest and poet Ernesto Cardenal had been doing with the poor of the islands of Sol and Tenon. Incidentally, he wrote a wonderful book called The Gospels of Sol and Tenon. The trek to Nicaragua changed me. When I got back, I was shooting pool with a friend on a Friday night when he stopped me from a shot and said, "Look, should have got off the pot." Turns out I'd been commenting about Nicaragua the whole night. Some of my best decisions have come when I got a hangover. That Saturday morning, I called a realtor friend, put my house on the market, called a couple of book dealers to sell my inventory, called an interior designer to offer my inventory of prints and photographs. On Sunday, I booked a flight for Antigua, Guatemala to attend a Spanish school, and I composed an invitation to all my friends and those on my mailing list. In the book trade, I sold the majority of my books by catalog for a going-away party. Eventually, when the party was held, over 250 people came through throughout the night. When I finally took off, I tried to think about what I was doing, what I was giving up. 2 weeks of Spanish schooling, I went to live in a small village in northern Guatemala where no one spoke English. A year later, my Spanish was pretty good. I started traveling around Guatemala, which I found beautiful. Taking photographs, I found I had a good eye from my years in visiting museums and selling photographs in the trade. Along the way, I discovered I was not interested in the meat market of independent photographers. I continued nonetheless and started to buy crafts and art from the region, returned to the U.S. to get money, sell the goods. I continued during those years maintaining my friendships with various traffic worker communities, on occasion leading small delegations around the region, including El Salvador. I felt the freedom I thought I'd looted me for most of my life. Money was a problem. I was usually alone, but met many fine people along the way. When my parents died, I went back to California to clean up their estate and to mourn. I'd been taking forensic pictures of mass graves in Guatemala when I first heard the news of my mother's death. In driving back, I went to again ask my questions. What am I doing? I ended up living precarious here in California until I could return to Catholic worker house in Des Moines, Iowa. In my mourning, I found that working at serving the poor was a great journey for me. It's really hard to indulge in self-pity when you're serving meals to the homeless. But the text above really doesn't answer that question of why am I living in Mexico. When I returned to San Cristobal in Mexico, I came leading a small delegation from Iowa. I ended up working with Don Samuel Ruiz, the bishop at the time. With help from Catholic workers in the U.S., I helped build an indigenous community center. With the very first daycare center for Indian girls, many who had been raped by Mexican soldiers during the Zapatista conflict. In truth, the daycare center was not only to care for the children, but also to teach the young girls how to live away from their families in a world they had never known. It was at the daycare center that I met my wife, Marcella, who worked in the glass house. And I kept going for glass to install in the windows of the community center. It was Kismet. She was also acting as a nanny for a dying family. are we hooked up on a matter of moving there after spending 6 months a year in San Cristobal and 6 months in Des Moines. And this, so I missed her, so I ended up moving to San Cristobal after a couple of years, where we bought a small farm outside the city, and I started building again. Again, now that Araceli has her papers for the U.S., she's living in Des Moines worker. Why am I still living here, visiting Des Moines twice a year? It's a complicated issue, and I plan on writing more about it next month as I try to examine what it is about Mexico and about Latin America that makes it home to me. So what do you think?
I think Mexico has become, you have really adopted it, and vice versa. And when I think of Richard Flamer, I think of Mexico before I think of the United States. I know you were born up here, and you fought for us in Vietnam, your reaction to that war in discovering that that war is a horrible thing and doesn't do anybody is a revelation and an inspiration.
It's a question that still troubles me, and I'm thinking that somehow it has to do with my spirit, but also my sense of adventure. I don't think there's an easy answer, but I'm going to try and pursue it a little more. Meanwhile, here, it's been... the rains finally stopped after 100 days of rain, consecutive days of rain.
You sent the rain up here. I mean, we've just dodged a bullet again here in Fort Lauderdale. The hurricane turned north and didn't hit us. But it's very strange to have a hurricane in November. It put a number on some areas not that far north from us.
Life here continues. It's one of the other reasons I like it so much here on the farm is that for the tranquility. Eamon Hennessy's, I think it was Eamon Hennessy, the Catholic worker, said that to do good is part of the reason that he became a Catholic worker. And I think that's also part one of the ways that I feel so much better living here. I'm able to do good and be good, whatever that means. But I'll pursue the rest of it next month.
I look forward to hearing the rest of it. It's with a very intriguing beginning.
Good. Good. Take care, Chuck, and hope to talk to you next month.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thanks again, Richard. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, some fascinating story there from Richard Flamer, looking back over the things that have made him who he is today. Very interesting. All right. Well, our final guest of the evening is Mickey Z. And Mickey asked me to play his most recent podcast. And I'm going to do that right about now. Here we go. This is, actually, before I do that, let me remind you, we are streaming live on Revolution Radio, and this is a listener-supported station, and they need your support. They deserve your support. So, do it. Show up over there. Go to freedomslips.com and look for one of the many ways that you can contribute to the operation of this station. It's entirely a listener-supported station, and whatever money you provide through donations or purchases, it all goes toward the operations of the station. Where freedom never sleeps, that's the motto. Okay. Now, Mickey Z has a podcast called Post Woke, and he recently interviewed Celia Farber on COVID, AIDS, Fauci, woke fascism, and more. And we're going to play a good portion of that podcast right here on the New American Dream. Here we go.
I'm Mickey Z, and I welcome you to Post Woke, the New York City-based podcast where we practice intellectual self-defense.
But they took it way too far. The wheels are coming off. I absolutely believe that we are winning, and our victory is assured.
That was Celia Farber, an investigative historian of deep fake virus agendas from HIV to COVID-19. And Celia is anti-tyranny in all of its forms. And I will be right back with the one and only Celia Farber after this short message from our sponsor. Hey, Mickey Z here, and I'm asking you to offer some support for a project that I've been running for nearly 6 years. It's called Helping Homeless Women NYC. And as the name implies, I've been getting out there on the streets, like I said, nearly 6 years to offer direct relief to some of the most vulnerable yet fiercest women you'll ever want to meet. If you check the show notes, you will find a direct link for how to donate at GoFundMe. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon patron or in ordering restaurant gift cards directly from my wish list, shoot me an email and I'll send you that information. But I'm just requesting some support, thanking you in advance, and asking you, no matter what, to please share the link far and wide. Now, let's get back to the show. And we're back. So, they used the faulty method, PCR, to allegedly diagnose COVID, encouraged the people who got a positive test from that faulty test to stay home until they felt much worse. And then when they finally showed up at the hospital, they were typically given remdesivir and put on a ventilator and sequestered away from their loved ones. And many of those poor souls died alone, victims of the protocol, not the virus. Now, I could only imagine that when Celia Farber heard about all this, she thought of Tony Fauci's weasel-like face inside this fucking guy again. Because if there's anyone out there who fully understands how Fauciism can kill people with supposed cures that are worse than supposed diseases, it's Celia. Celia has warned us that we are in a war for the soul of science, and I'm proud to have her join me here today to talk about all this and more. So, Celia, welcome to Post Woke.
Mickey, so good to be with you. That was a very, very, you're so exacting, and that was such a great introduction. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. It's been a long time coming. Perhaps at some point we'll touch on how we knew each other 25 years ago. But right now I'm going to just dive in and say that, as I was mentioning to you before we started recording, I've written a lot about issues like propaganda tactics, particularly used to justify wars and military interventions. But in that process, I've learned that, like war propaganda, medical propaganda works in a somewhat predictable manner. And one brand of that, Fauciism, commenced in the 80s and 90s. Now, you call Fauci a social engineer. So for all those folks who first heard of Fauci only in the year 2020, what can you tell us about a man with this much blood on his hands?
Wow. Where do I begin? Okay, great question. Great questions. So I'm glad you started us off there with the social engineer. One of the reasons that's a concept for me is because I grew up in Sweden. I'm American, born in New York City, but my mom was Swedish, and when the marriage broke up, she took us to Sweden. I was 11 years old and lived there for eight years during a time of I would say, like, industrial social engineering that took place in Sweden in a way that I don't know that it took place anywhere else, hardly in the world. By social engineering, I mean that the state apparatus is so heavy on the individual, on the citizen, on the family, on the man, on the woman, on the child, and changing how they see themselves, each other, their lives, their morals, everything. Like the same way that people accuse organized religion, I see that in, the social engineering emanating from the state, right? And when I came back to America, the big idea was, well, thank God there's none of that in America, because America is a free country and everyone kind of does what they want and there isn't some big brother entity breathing down people's necks. It crept in through totalitarian public health, Tony Fauci and Fauciism. And I think my most important quote in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book, it's a quote that I feel very strongly about. It's a long quote, and he ran the whole thing. I actually sent it in as a piece of writing because it came to me in a blinding flash that Tony Fauci's most radical, revolutionary, and dangerous role was that he brought wokeism, I know will resonate with you, woke and wokeism into science, medicine, biology, public health. Sorry about the beeping. I try to turn off all the things on my
It's quite all right.
Okay. By social engineering, what I mean is, okay, let's just take the easiest example, COVID, or the most recent example, not the easiest example. He doesn't really address contagion, what is known, what is not known. I mean, he pretends he is, but he isn't. He's not speaking as an epidemiologist, as, for example, Anders Tegnell in Sweden was doing, speaking as an epidemiologist to the Swedish people, always saying, if you have symptoms, stay home. You know, in other words, the whole thing, in the way it played out in Sweden, was so bound to the reality of what they see as contagious illness, which is, as you and I know, a whole other kettle fish. But what is Fauci doing over here in America? He's getting on television night after night after night, and he's fundamentally changing, as is the apparatus and the commercials and the ads and the propaganda, in lockstep with Fauci, changing the way we view our lives as Americans. What does that mean? Well, they say there's a new virus going around. That means I'm going to leave grandma to die in a plastic bag, with no last rites, even though she's a lifelong devoted Catholic, et cetera, right? That's actually social engineering. In other words, using a virus and using a fake scare paradigm. I mean, the scare is very real, but the so-called science is very fake. Using that to shatter and reshape how we live and how we think about one another. And his obsession is separation and no touch. It was with AIDS and it is with COVID. Distance, distance, distance. In other words, if you don't have to be near someone, touch someone, you might even say love someone, then don't. That's his worldview. The only value is avoid the virus and kill the virus. Avoid the virus and kill the virus. Okay, so you kill all the people too, you kill the whole community, you kill everybody's hopes and dreams, so be it. But you attack the virus. That's his obsession. He developed it and fomented it during AIDS, and then he threw it down on the entire U.S. population during COVID.
Wow, I appreciate that lens from which you just described that, and it reminds me of the famous line from a U.S. colonel in Vietnam. It became necessary to destroy the town in order to save it. The collateral damage is irrelevant to him. But I'm curious.
Wow, I forgot about that. That fits so perfectly. That's right. It's the same mentality. It's the same people. It's the same machine.
Yes.
You know, these are military organs. These are arms of the military. NIH, HHS, CDC. People don't understand. You know that, right? This is the military. These are not medical organizations.
Yeah, you look at Fauci's salary when he was, I think it was George W. Bush put him under the purview of the military, and you saw his salary skyrocket under the alleged vibe of protecting us from bioterror, and it's that connection is lost there. And yeah, the town that in Vietnam is called Ben Tre, and no one really uses the phrase, but it's called Ben Tre logic, and I feel like that should come back into play because we're witnessing it in so many theaters. But I want to focus in on you using the word woke. Now, back in the 80s and 90s, when it wasn't in fashion, perhaps we called it back then political correctness. But
right.
I think what you're really getting at is thought crimes, cancel culture, ruined careers, like around the time of the AIDS crisis, where if you didn't march in lockstep, there was a version of Twitter in a way that people would pile on you, the scientific community and the media lapdogs would pile on you and remove you from the scene. So when you talk about woke in the context of early Fauci, what does that come out of?
Yeah, okay. The early Fauci woke comes out of, I feel that AIDS was, I'm going to leave aside polio for the time being, because I think there all of this really, a lot of it kicks in during so-called polio. But AIDS, in earnest, what happens is you have post-Stonewall gay culture as a power block that makes a decision from within, that is to say Larry Kramer, essentially, and his cadre. And the decision is made, what goes on in the bathhouses will not be communicated to the heterosexual world, media, congressmen, etc. We're going to block that off, and this was literally a conflict that happened between Larry Kramer on the one hand and Richard Berkowitz, Michael Callan, and Joe Sonnabend on the other, and those guys were the inventors of what later became Safe Sex, which was designed for sexually active gay men in the big cities. It was not supposed to be something that went out across the country, a pamphlet under every door. So, okay, let me back up a little. I'm maybe going a little bit too fast, but okay, back to woke, 80s, AIDS, and Fauci. So what's happening is, so gay men are indeed becoming very sick from a syndrome that initially is called gay cancer. It's later called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. It is real. It is scary. It's new. It's mysterious. And early on, as I've documented, and many have documented, the so-called virus hunters, the Bob Gallows and all of that whole generation of retrovirologists and so-called virologists who didn't have a virus really to to play with, right, to attach to a terrible disease. They were lying in wait, and they were saying before the 1984 press conference, it's going to be a retrovirus. This thing is going to be caught. In other words, there was a will, right? There was a will for AIDS to be caught, to have a single cause and for it to be exactly the kind of virus that they were interested in, that they were educated in, and that they wanted to get funding for. And every time I say virus and retrovirus, I mean it in quotation marks.
Okay.
You know, that's another show, another time. Okay, so woke and AIDS is like the perfect marriage, because it was necessary for the money they wanted to raise and what they called awareness, which was like an atomic bomb of terror over people. AIDS awareness required this very strange, watered down version of who was getting sick and why and how they were getting sick, and the absolutely forbidden thing back then, political correctness, as you pointed out, is what it was called. The forbidden thing was to use the word lifestyle, or to point out that there was anything that the sick gay men were doing that could have been causing and exacerbating this illness. So you weren't allowed to talk about the bathhouses and poppers and the antibiotics and all the different drugs and all that, because then you were homophobic. I mean, I'm just radically simplifying, but basically this was the hardcore messaging that came down. And if you were homophobic, you got some very scary people and attacks against you in the form of ACT UP, who were seen as saints and heroes. There were entire periodicals shut down. They shut down Cosmopolitan. I think they shut down the whole magazine because they had a doctor named Dr. Robert Gould. I can't recall if he was a psychiatrist or what he was, but he wrote a piece saying heterosexuals are unlikely to contract, as they put it, HIV or AIDS, and there's really nothing to worry about. And they went completely berserk. I mean, there are so many of these stories, right, of the woke brigade of the time, led by sacred AIDS activists, dictating to media, to the public, with Fauci kind of the puppet master at the top, dictating what you were allowed to say about AIDS and what you were not allowed to say. And if the true cause got away in all of this, well, so be it. It was better to say the right thing, the Elton John ordained precious thing to say, that Elizabeth Taylor, whoever, than to say the thing that actually had connection to real medicine, epidemiology, or recovery, like the stuff Gary Null was talking about. He was the very first. He was talking about when people who have this syndrome, and we take them to, you know, high dose vitamin C and detox, and we do this and we do that, and they get better. I think it was I still think it's a mystery what happened back there and how those men got so sick. And I don't think anyone has ever truly cracked the multifactorial model. But it was super clear that if you wanted to have a life, a name, a profession, an income, anything at all, you sang the single virus song and the anybody can get it song, and everybody's one broken condom away from it, and anyway, et cetera, et cetera. And that was all complete and utter BS, doggerel, nonsense, fiction. None of it was borne out you tell me, Mickey, where's the heterosexual explosion that was going to happen? You remember all of it.
Oh, yeah, right? I remember the scares. And then when the Magic Johnson news came out, that seemed to be quote-unquote proof. Look, anybody can get this. And so it trying to put that what would later on be a COVID-like scare on the whole population.
Yeah, Magic Johnson, that's I was speaking to somebody about this yesterday. Pharma is so evil, and we can't think like them. And every time that's why they keep winning, is because they're evil. It just moves so fast. So the way they're evil destroyed Magic Johnson was for whatever reason they decided. I don't know why he was a target, but He tested positive on the not important antibody test. I don't know if it was ELISA, Western blot, and or PCR, but they decided that this guy has tested positive on our dubious diagnostic tests, which say in the test inserts, this test cannot determine the presence or absence of HIV. Nevertheless, he gets caught in the net, no pun intended, he gets caught in the net and he's labeled HIV, and he's a heterosexual man and a super strong, incredible athlete, and he's black. So now they have themselves somebody who can do more propaganda work for them, you know, because they really wanted to target. And I remember those days when he first got into the net, so to speak, right, when he became the poster boy for I have it, and if I got it, anybody can get it. So the deal was, you can't play basketball anymore because our psychological operation holds that, you know, sweat and everything can spread the virus. So you're no longer an athlete, but what you're going to make more money than you made before. We're going to give you just one of the contracts that I learned about once many years ago was $60 million just for one poster campaign to say,
wow.
Just to keep repeating that from, I don't know which pharmacy. I'm not going to name a pharmaceutical company right now in case I get it wrong, but one of the very big ones, right? And I remember the posters with Magic Johnson, I can get it, anybody can get it. They began, I when I was living in the city, I haven't been for the last couple of years, but I always lived in what used to be Spanish Harlem and then became the Upper West Side, so like 102nd and between Broadway and FCM. And the posters, the propaganda posters with Magic, they all started around 116th Street, and they really picked up around 125th Street. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So they were really targeting the black community with demoralization campaigns and fear campaigns. And all those years, I didn't quite get it. And now I do, that all of these arrows point to depopulation. Sterilization campaigns, eugenics campaigns.
Wow. Okay. I didn't expect that turn there, but I it's something that I've also, you know, found myself being aimed in that direction. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah. The AIDS apparatus, they've always been, I find them to be very racist. And the theory itself is proto-racist. The theory, which was never proven, and it's crazy. It's that there was, I believe, somebody was said to have had sexual intercourse in Africa with a so-called green monkey, which is what caused the virus to leap from the monkey species to the human species. And then there was an equally fictional patient zero, who was made up by Randy Schultz, and he kept trying to tell people, I made it up, called Gaetan Dugas was his name. There was a real person, and he was a promiscuous, very beautiful gay man, was a flight attendant, flew all around the world and had a lot of sex. So what they're selling to the public at this moment in time is transmission models. They want people to think like this. New dangerous viruses emerging from distant parts of the world and spreading unbeknownst. And this is against everything that is known by serious and fair people and decent people about nature, which is, it goes against everything. It's like a bad horror film. Nature doesn't operate like this at all. So what happened, so to elaborate on the depopulation, so I crossed Africa in the early 90s for a series for Spin magazine that was published in two parts. And I went looking for the so-called AIDS pandemic in Africa. And what we were a team of three, a scientist and two journalists. And what we found was that they had taken all conventional subtropical diseases such as malaria and tuberculosis, and just told all the people that they had AIDS now, which was called Slim disease. Didn't even require a test. And what those people the way the spell worked in Africa is that once they were told Slim disease, they basically just died. They gave up. Their people gave up on them. They would just go down to the river and die, almost like voodoo or bone pointing. So, like, the psychological attackery in this whole thing is way bigger than anybody has ever acknowledged. In terms of depopulation, let's go to the first most simple message of AIDS. There's a new virus. It's deadly. It kills you if you get it. So don't get it. Use a condom every time. So that message is actually really strange, but it was normalized for all of us at the time. And one of the reasons it's really strange is because prior to this, sex was known to cause life. As far as I know, nobody ever heavy bombarded us with the message that sex causes death and can kill you, and you can, you know, make love with a person, as it was quaintly known back then, and kill them, or unintentionally kill them. All of these ideas are very, they're very dark, they're very sinister, and I believe that the only way I can try to make sense of them is that they are tied in with campaigns that were around earlier in the period you've studied, like the Margaret Sanger period, eugenics, where the idea was to demoralize people, stop them from having children, encourage them to have abortions, and scare them away from essentially one another. And that's what I could be wrong, but that's what I see now when I look at, like, why did they do it? Why did they do it? It was just one arm of the octopus of NWO agenda that now most of us are really familiar with.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Because let me just step for 1 second and clarify to listeners who may not be familiar with you that when I'm asking you questions about the AIDS crisis, you were the go-to investigative journalist at that time, and your article still exists online. You have a book out, The Sins of Omission. Am I correct on that?
The book is coming out soon. It's called, didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'll just tell you, it's called Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS.
Okay, so I'm going to put a link in the show notes for that. And so when you're speaking, the credibility you have is immense, because I can remember reading you at the time, but this work continues. So I just want to clarify for people who may not know that. But to go back to the depopulation, what's fascinating is what used to sound, when you use that word, it would just be instantly tinfoil hat, and, you know. But now that Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum just basically like narrating their plans publicly before they do it, like, you can find quotes from Kissinger to right along up into the World Economic Forum and Gates in particular, where they talk quite openly in their opinion, what would be ideal populations, and people could dismiss that at their own peril. So if the parasites in charge right now are talking openly about this, then we should be talking openly about this. So I just want to say that I welcome this conversation, and the points you made sound incredibly valid, and it's a tie into the racism also, where practicing depopulation on the continent of Africa, it being where they started, with at least with AIDS, seems like it ties into your message of how the entire AIDS campaign was very racist.
Yeah, and I want to actually, there's one point I'm jumping out of my seat to make here.
Please make it.
About the racism of the, so the AIDS apparatus, the AIDS crowd, the AIDS in crowd, they're supposed to be better than us and more moral than us and more woke and more, you know, against racism and all these things, right? But here was their actual theory about how, why, like, one would say at a certain point in history when the heterosexual AIDS explosion failed to manifest, let's say one is at a gathering of these kinds of people, they would say, oh, well, but it's in Africa. It's in Africa. That's why I had to go to Africa. No, it wasn't in Africa. Anyway, okay, it's in Africa. All right. Now, why do you think it's spreading so bad in Africa in ways that it's not spreading among highly sexually active people in the West? I mean, the Western world is pretty sexually active. Why wouldn't rock stars and porn stars and so on and so forth have it, or a Bill Clinton, for that matter, or a Jeffrey Epstein, for that matter.
Yeah.
And they would say, oh, and this is based on an article, on several very racist articles that were published in The New Yorker, most of them written by Michael Spector. And they posited, I kid you not, that African men prefer dry sex. Wait for it. And that in order to have dry sex, for their women to be dry, that they would make mysterious herbal pouches, insert those, and when the women would insert them, which would dry out the vaginal area, and then the man could have the experience of dry sex, which is unwilling sex, which is essentially rape. So this was the New Yorker stamped and approved theory, and that by this method, micro tears occurred in the vaginal regions of African women per se, that were different from anything that happened in the Western world.
Oh,
and that's how the virus gained entry. That was the theory.
So that explains it.
Jeez. Is that racist, Mickey? What are you?
My
would you
God,
call
it's like those wacky Africans. Look what they came up with, and now they're giving. You know, after they're having sex with monkeys, now they're giving it to their women. And it's like
beyond belief. It's like beyond,
yeah,
beyond,
yeah,
beyond the cartoon. You know, it's like, and this was, this is how they continued, and they continued to have the upper hand morally. To have all the money and all the glitz and all the always telling us how to think and how to be and what to do. And so my strange role in all of this, I guess, is to shine my flashlight on the dark racist and anti-human origins of AIDS and COVID. Same people, same ideas.
Yeah. All right, so before we move to COVID, I do want to ask you, because you're going to know these answers. You mentioned Larry Kramer. Now, if you do a web search of Larry Kramer and Anthony Fauci, you'll find ACT UP writing this pretty, strongly worded open letter to Fauci, calling him a pimp for Big Pharma. Now, I know that Kramer and Fauci eventually reconciled, but was that public show? They were in their own way collaborating behind the scenes?
Yeah, so good, great question. The theater, I think it was theater. I think it was planned, and I think it was very successful. Don't have proof that it was planned. Sometimes these things may happen somewhat organically, but here's the way, as far as the public was concerned, that Tony Fauci was first cast as the evil, you know, you're killing us, Dr. Fauci. Why? Because he wasn't approving AIDS drugs fast enough. So whose psyop might that be? Who benefits? Right?
Okay.
Pharma, because it's like, give me my drugs now. Testing for safety and efficacy was equated with murder by the ACT UP crowd. And so Fauci was initially like a kind of fuddy-duddy father figure who was getting in the way of saving lives because he was supposedly so homophobic. And then he has this kind of moment of enlightenment, and he sits on a bench with Larry Kramer, and they have this breakthrough, and they become allies, right? And now Fauci invites the activists inside the gates of the palace. Now they're at the table, and they're calling the shots at the NIAID meeting.
Kumbaya theater there. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for clearing. Because you, it's, like I said, I've done a search and I found that letter, and you see there's still photos of activists in the early 90s holding signs, just like you said, Dr. Fauci, you're killing us, but without the context of what they meant, that they're saying, please give us more Big Pharma. And okay, I took it that he was so pro Big Pharma that he was killing them with AZT and they were hip to it. But
there was a faction of ACT UP on the West Coast called ACT UP San Francisco that did say precisely that, and they were destroyed, thrown into prison. The two main leaders died in prison, the leaders of that group. They were like, it's like when ACT UP became, you know, what everybody thought ACT UP really was. That was ACT UP San Francisco, and they were putting out leaflets and flyers and huge campaigns saying, AZT's killing us, AZT's killing us. and the whole AIDS activist and AIDS organizational kind of apparatus turned viciously against these guys. There were only a handful of them.
Okay.
And they sent the false charges of whatever it was. You know, they didn't do anything that any other active person didn't do at a conference. They destroyed some property maybe, but they were thrown in jail and they died. That's an important story, a very scary story.
Absolutely, and it's incredible context because I've tried researching it and I didn't. There were pieces that seemed to be missing, and you just filled some of them in. And one more thing on this time period, when you're talking about this decision to essentially disguise how certain risky habits could be the genesis of this. Quote-unquote pandemic, and calling it woke or politically correct, and Fauci was involved in that. Did he, from your perspective, was he in line with such political correct mindset, or was what was in it for him, was it this growth in power to become sort of the J. Edgar Hoover of the medical world? Like maybe he was already envisioning, I'm going to be in this office till I die, and this is my entry point. Or do you feel like he has an ideological connection to the woke /
Great question. I've wondered about that. He's very hard to read. It's almost like he's a blank. He is a as I've pointed out, he's a trained Jesuit, and I've called him a trained Jesuit and committed globalist, right? So does he believe in his woke utterances? I think it's fair to say that people like him who are kind of high operators for NWO, that yeah, they've taken the agenda in. I don't think that he believes in anything true. Let me think about this for a moment. Like, in other words, do I think that Anthony Fauci wants to save the lives of Africans or gay men or anybody else? No, I believe he's completely. I believe he's actually hidden to himself. I don't think he knows himself. I just think he was such a perfect puppet for the system,
yeah,
and a perfect operator. And it wasn't until Robert F. Kennedy Jr. decided to put a circle around Fauci and really he became his nemesis. He's Fauci's first real nemesis. That even I understood how central he was to all of these catastrophes. I used to mistake him for a rather bland but vicious, spiteful bureaucrat. I mean, how can you be bland and vicious at the same time? I knew a lot about how he persecuted, targeted, and took out dissenting scientists, most famously Peter Duisberg. I knew a lot about that. I've never had any real sense, who is he? What does he believe in? I know that he has said he was raised Catholic and he's no longer a Catholic, that he believes in some kind of religion called humanism. I think he's a humanist, and I think that's actually, as lovely as it sounds, that's a big red flag. This all has to do with technocracy, a new world order, genetics, agenda 2030. It's like they all speak the same strange language where you can't tell what they think, what they feel, what they believe in. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's a hard call.
It's like they've become the AI that they use to promote their messages. Like
they're very AI-ish. Yes.
Yeah.
And Fauci believes in fighting viruses, eradicating viruses, anticipating and fighting global pandemics. Like that's probably, if he wakes up in the middle of the night, what he babbles about, right? but what does that mean to him? Who is he really? I think that is something. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. didn't go into this anything personal particularly about Tony Fauci, and I think he remains kind of unknowable.
I would agree. That's why I asked the question. After reading Kennedy's book, it's like this catalog of crime, but you're still left with this wondering about the criminal mastermind at the center of it, which ultimately, I mean, we need him to be held accountable and pay a price for this, but it would help in terms of preventing future Faucis as to how he got to this point and stayed in power so long, which I always compare to J. Edgar Hoover, another guy who just seemed to transcend administration after administration, where he just had, I can't really explain what it was about these men that enabled them to never get kicked out of office, even by Trump, for that matter. But
an excellent analogy, J. Edgar Hoover. That's perfect. That's perfect. I hadn't ever thought of that, but they're very similar archetypes, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think Hoover's maybe the only one who will end up in appointed, non-elected, but powerful position longer than Fauci. But the damage both of them did is almost incalculable. Now,
what would you say J. Edgar Hoover believed in?
That's an excellent question, because I have done, my dad was in law enforcement, and I've done a fair amount of reading, and growing up in New York and Italian, like, you know, mafia guys, and you try to figure out what, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. And for the longest time, Hoover denied the existence of organized crime. And you went to, like, what's behind this? But I've never heard a convincing analysis as to what his daily motivating passions were beyond maintaining that office and that power. And maybe at some point everything gets transcended by that, where Fauci wakes up every morning just wanting to remain essentially the health czar of the United States for the past 35, 40 years.
A very interesting interview with Celia Farber and Mickey Z, and you can listen to the rest of it by finding Post Woke, Mickey Z's podcast. This was a great show tonight. Thank you so much for being here to listen, and I hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on the New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen, with host Zen Garcia, at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what...